Okay, so today the koan picker picked the 31st patriarch Dai Zenji from the Denko Rokko book. I've lately been getting quite a few from Denko Rokko. But anyway, it's a wonderful koan, and it chronicles the experience, the enlightenment experience of the fourth patriarch, the fourth Chinese patriarch, which is the 31st patriarch in the Indian lineage. So when you look at our lineage chart, it goes all the way back from Shakyamuni Buddha to today. But when you look at Kaizen's, who was the author of this particular book, when you look at his lineage, it goes all the way up to just before Kaizen, 12th century in Japan. So this is the 31st patriarch that he chronicled. And remember, it's called the transmission of light. So in this particular case, every koan describes what it is the teacher or the patriarch in this case has seen. That was actually that. What is the transmission? What is the transmission? What is it that Buddhism transmits? The same question can be asked of Christianity or any religion. What is it actually that they transmit? Okay, so it really points to that point. You know, what is it that they transmit? You know, so here we have the one from the 31st patriarch or fourth Chinese patriarch. So his name is Dai Zenji. He was born in 580 and he died in 651. So he lived for 72 years, and we're talking about a period that is now 1,444 years. So since that's when he was born, so 1,444 years ago in China. So I'll read out the case. The 31st patriarch, Dai Zenji. He bowed deeply to the great master Kanji. So it would have been the third patriarch. So he bowed deeply to the master Kanji and said, "I beg you, master, have mercy on me. Please grant me the Dharma gate of liberation. Grant me the Dharma gate of liberation." The patriarch said, "Who is binding you? Who is binding you?" And the master said, "There's no one binding me." And the patriarch said, "Then why do you search for further liberation? Why do you search for further liberation?" And by these words, the master came to great enlightenment. So this is the case. I feel it's very, very important case. Not so much because it's the fourth patriarch, but the message that is here. And of course, it comes up in quite a few koans, that same message, and you will have heard me talk about it over and over again. But ultimately, this is what it's all about. This is definitely what it's all about. So he asked the question, you know, "Please grant me the Dharma gate of liberation." So, and then the next a question that his teacher asked him, "What's binding you?" So, of course, most of us know the answer to, you know, what is the gate of liberation? We can say it's Buddhism. We can say, you know, we can say many, many things, you know. And in fact, the gate of liberation is the entire Buddhist project. You know, that's what it's all about. It's about liberation. Liberation from what? Why is it that we aren't liberated, even those that have had Kensho experiences? In many instances, feel like they're not liberated. There's something there that, oh, they want more. It means they haven't seen. Why is it? What is it? What's holding us back? So what's binding you? Is it the mortgage? Your children? They're binding you? Your partner, husband or wife, are they binding you? What about your health? Is your health binding you? The politics of the day. Are the politics binding us? What's binding you? That's a really important question to ask. Doesn't matter what stage we are at, what is binding you? And, you know, this is obviously what this, you know, what this child, actually he was 14 years old when he asked this question. You know, he's 14 years old. We'll get to that a little bit later on when we delve into the background of this master. But please, just sit with this. What is binding you? What is binding you? Anxiety. What about anxiety? Is that binding you? Anxiety? In other words, there's this thing called anxiety, and that doesn't allow me to go any further? You know. What's binding you? Your job? Is your job binding you? So do you think another job will not bind you? What is it? What's binding you? Economic conditions? There's just so many things that fall into this. This is binding me. So anyway, that was the question. You know, please free. He's saying, please have mercy upon me and grant me the Dharma gate of liberation. So now we've got two, we generally in Buddhism, there are two ways of looking at this. One way is the ultimate way, which is what Zen is all about. So the approach is the ultimate way, and we'll get to that in a minute. And the other way is the relative way, which is the conventional way. In other words, you identify all the things that are binding us and you chip away at it. And before we go into this koan, I just want to look at the conventional way. And if you look at the end of this, if you look at right at the end of this sheet of paper here, this is a this comes from the Pali Canon. So this is what they call early Buddhist teaching. So these were recorded, whether it came from the Buddha or not. Some people dispute it, some people don't. It's a matter of faith. We ultimately, of course, we don't know because it's so long ago. But this is like the earliest teachings, you know, of Buddhism, if you like, in the Indian tradition. But of course, Buddhism has migrated into different perspectives, including Mahayana, Hinayana, all these different perspectives that occur. And ultimately, we can categorize them under the relative or the absolute way. But this is a relative perspective, and this is very interesting. So in this particular case, it's called Balisata Sutta. So this is a sutta, an original sutta. And it's called a hook. So the sutta's name is a hook. And it said, et sabbati, possessions, honor, and popularity are brutal, bitter, and harsh. They are an obstacle to reaching the supreme sanctuary from the yoke. So an obstacle to reaching the supreme sanctuary from the yoke. So the yoke is what binds us. What's binding you, okay? The yoke, like a yoke. Like we got this yoke on us. We can't move any further. We got this yoke, okay? So he's saying possessions. So this is the Buddha, you know. He's saying this according to this sutra. Possessions, honor, and popularity are brutal, bitter, and harsh. They're an obstacle to reaching the supreme sanctuary from the yoke. Suppose a fisherman was to cast a baited hook into a deep lake. Seeing the bait, a fish would swallow it. And so the fish that swallowed the hook would meet with tragedy and disaster. And the fisherman can do what he wants with it. Fisherman is a term for Mara the wicked. So those that don't know much about Buddhism, Mara is like another word for the devil. If you like. Fisherman is a term for Mara the wicked. Hook is a term for possessions, honor, and popularity. Whoever enjoys the likes, arisen possessions, honor, and popularity is called a mendicant who has swallowed Mara's hook. They've met with tragedy and disaster, and the wicked one can do with them what he wants. So just on that, so obviously the teaching is to monastics, you know, even in Zen, it's, you know, it's only just recently that the teachings, you know, became available to lay people like us. So we always got to remember that it is to monastics. So monastics, of course, are not allowed to have possessions for that simple reason, that they bind us, possessions bind us, according to this. So today we could say, you know, in our, from our perspective, it's not possessions that bind us, it's the attachment to possessions that bind us. You know, we are attached to this, of course. You know, of course we have to have possessions, you know, whether it's clothing, or you can't be without any possessions, but it's that attachment. So you can look at possessions like attachment, and then it becomes relevant again to us, I think. Mara, okay, you might think, oh, the devil, these are all ancient concepts, but they're ancient concepts. The way they word them and the way they describe them, yes, they're ancient, but modern, we have new words for that, like shadows. These are our shadows. Psychology would call it that. Our shadows is what binds us, our belief system, all that stuff that psychology is talking about. These are our shadows. That is Mara, that critical voice that is nagging, that is never satisfied. Our intellect that is continuously searching and searching and searching and can never, ever get to a book where that's the answer. There it is. There is not one book amongst millions of books that will give us that answer. There it is. Why? Because of Mara, because of our shadow, because of our intellect that then goes, but hang on, but what about this? And what about this? And we could always say, what about this? And what about this? That is why we can never find it. Impossible to find, as long as we keep on asking that question. Why? There comes a point where we need to stop it. Just sit. This intellect of ours, this mental process is like the wind that continuously comes up and moves along. It is never ending. We'll never find the answer there. This is the hook. That's the hook, like a fisherman, you know, that like a fish where we swallow the hook of the intellect, and the Mara can do with us whatever it wants. Or our shadow, our own belief system. We're just running in circles and circles and circles and circles. And of course, another name for all of this is samsara. So brutal, it continues, so brutal are possessions, honor, and popularity. So brutal are attachments, I'll just replace the word possessions for attachments. Honor, we all want honor, popular, we all want to be popular. What will they think of me if I do that? It's all about me, this whole concept of me, of course. You know, so brutal are possessions, honor, and popularity, bitter and harsh, an obstacle to reaching the supreme sanctuary of the yoke. So you should train like this. We will give up arisen possessions, honor, and popularity, and we won't let them occupy our minds. That's how you should train. So, and of course, there's a whole teaching about meditation and you let go of it. And then that's the conventional way of teaching. How do we unhook ourselves from whatever is binding us? So we have, you know, there's so many books written about this. There's a whole movement. I mean, this is occupied philosophers and the New Age movement and Buddhism and Christianity. All the religions are all about this. And now here we come back to the koan now. And you see it from an absolute point of view. So when you come back to the koan, and it says the 31st patriarch, Dai Zenji, he bowed deeply to Great Master Kanji and said, I beg you, Master, have mercy on me. Please grant me the Dharma gate of liberation. Okay. So from a Zen perspective, as most of you would know, the teaching is not about how to get there bit by bit in a relative way. It's about you got to realize right from the start what is binding you. That's the question. What is actually binding you? The patriarch said, "Who is binding you? Or what is binding you?" The master said, "There is no one binding me." I mean, again, now, please get in contact, please get in touch with that. Right now, what is binding you? And I think most of us could honestly say, there is no one binding me. You can leave. You can go. You can do whatever you want. There's no one binding you. Then, why do you search for further liberation? Why do you search? Why do you keep searching? Now we're getting into Mara's territory. We are not happy with that. Hang on a second. That can't, there's something, there's this part of us that just doesn't accept that. That part of us that continuously challenges that. But why do you keep on searching? By these words, the master came to great enlightenment. So here, of course, you know, the master, which is the fourth patriarch, he was ready. He had, at that moment, he had a shift. There was a shift that took place where he all of a sudden, his dualism, if you like, or his sense of himself collapsed. And he saw that. And that's what needs to happen. Because while we've got a me and a you, you know, then we have a lot of things that bind us. As long as I have a sense of here am I, then I've got to defend that. Then there is a you. There's a me and there's a you. And if I need to defend that, I am trapped. That is what's binding me. That's the main issue here. You know, that's the part that is binding me, is the sense of me. Who am I? What am I? Who are you? What are you? What is this? What is that? That's that part. So what's interesting is too is that what is binding you? What is binding me? Even the phrase, the way it is formulated, what is binding you? You know, in itself is already phrased in a you and me dichotomy, in a you and me framework, if you like, duality. What is binding you? You know, so because there's still a you there, and there's a binding that takes place. That needs to be dissolved, and of course that's not easy. But we now will look at the background of the master. We'll go through that fairly quickly, and then the teisho that Kaizen gave on that, which will shed much more light on that as well. So first of all, the background of the fourth patriarch. The master's name was Doshin. His family name was Siba. For generations, the family had lived in Kenai. Later, they moved to Konzai, district in Qi province. From birth, he was quite extraordinary. In his childhood, he cherished various gates or teachings of liberation, of the schools that taught emptiness. Of the schools that taught emptiness. So it's actually, in Buddhism, it's quite auspicious. If you can get to a school, you know, or if you can read about this notion of emptiness, the emptiness school, if you like, or the essential part versus the phenomenal part, then it's considered very lucky. You're very lucky that we are lucky that we actually can hear about this. You know, the Buddha is the first one, according to many, whether he was the first one, of course, we don't know, that has really articulated this. Some people call it truth, whatever you want to call it, this aspect of there being an essential or an empty world, in equally there is a phenomenal world. We'll talk about that in a minute, a little bit more about that. So he was quite extraordinary in his childhood. He cherished various teachings of liberation, of the schools that taught emptiness. There are, even today, there are not many schools that teach it. You know, Christianity is almost, they don't teach it anymore. I don't know if the Muslims teach it. Buddhism, only in Buddhism, there's only few schools that actually teach this. left. Just as if he had learned them since his former lives. When he became 14 years old, he came to see the great master, the third patriarch, for instructions and asked him, I beg you, master, have mercy on me, and so on. So this comes back to the koan. So he was 14 years old. By the way, just don't think that that is not possible at 14. I had a phone call on Thursday from Catherine at Bodhi Chan. And she said, there's a 13-year-old boy that is pestering me who wants to become a monk. A 13-year-old boy. And she said, he rang me already 4 times. He's really determined. What do I do? Of course, it's extraordinary. A 13-year-old, obviously, there's parental guidance and all of this, and it's impossible for a 13-year-old nowadays to join a monastery. But it just shows you that there are children out there. I don't know how legitimate that child is, of course not. But nevertheless, for a child to ring up a monastery at 13, asking how to become, a monastic, that is quite extraordinary. When I read this, it just reminded me of this. So anyway, he was 14 years, quite amazing. He obeyed and practiced under the third patriarch. He obeyed and practiced under the third patriarch. By the way, obedience, as I keep on saying quite often, it doesn't matter whether it's a Christian tradition or the Buddhist tradition, obedience is another ego-lowering exercise. It's necessary to let go. What are we obedient to? Even the obedience to our practice. There's one part of us that says, why am I doing this? Why am I doing a prostration? Why am I walking this way? There's always why am I doing it this way and not the other way? What? Obedience. Obedience is nothing other than letting go. Obedience is total freedom. If you can be obedient, you're free. The hook is the ego that doesn't want to do it. That's the hook. The ego comes along and says, oh no, me, I want it this way, I want it this way. That's the hook. But obedience is, oh my God, I can let go. I just go with the flow, whatever the flow is. That's obedience, at one stage anyway, I struggled with obedience until I got that, And it's not easy to obey, but it is it's freedom. So he obeyed and practiced under the third patriarchs for 9 years. Later, he received the precepts in Kishi province, respected them, and venerated them. The patriarch often examined him concerning the deep subtleties, and when he knew the time was ripe, he conferred him the robe and bowl. So this is conferring the robe and bowl. Nowadays, the symbols are this. That's the symbol today for the robe and bowl. So this is like, okay, he was ready now to pass it on to others. He's ready now to teach it to others. That's what that means. The master succeeded to and revered the spirit of the third patriarch. So notice the spirit, we got to be careful that we don't sort of stick to the letter of it, but the spirit of it. And the spirit of it means that there's less danger to become dogmatic, That's what the spirit of it means, that's the way I read it. He managed his heart and remained awake, So he managed his heart and remained awake, so focused. He remained focused, His flank did not touch a seat for nearly 60 years. To what degree this is true, we don't know. Remember, this was written a long time ago. So apparently it says here that he never slept, for 60 years, which is very unlikely. But we hear of that quite often, that they kept on being awake. So in the 13th year of Diago of Zui, 617, he went to Kishi province with his followers. A band of robbers had surrounded the city for 70 days, and all people were terrified. The master took pity upon them and taught them to recite the Makka Prajna Paramita Sutta, which is the one that we recite here at the end of the end of the day. When the band of robbers peeped through the city walls and through the hedges, it looked as if they were a host of supernatural soldiers. So they were scared. They looked through, and all of a sudden saw all these people reciting, presumably, the sutra, and they got a little bit scared about that. And they said to each other, there must be an extraordinary man inside the city. We cannot attack. They were very superstitious, of course, in those days. By the way, that story here comes up quite a few. When I researched this master in various forms, that story comes up all the time. So whether it's true or not, we don't know, but it certainly does come up. So they gradually went away. In the seventh year of Butoku of the Tang Dynasty, 624, the master returned to the province of Qi. In the spring, he stayed on Mount Hatsu. Practicing monks gathered like clouds. One day, upon a road in Obai, he intensively taught Conan, the fifth patriarch, and also produced a side branch on Mount Gosu. So in other words, he became quite famous. One of the things that he's famous for, by the way, is that he is accredited of establishing the first Zen monastery. So in those days, the third patriarch, fourth patriarch, they were still living in not Zen monasteries, if you like. They were living in other monasteries. So he is credited of having the first Zen monastery, according to what I've been reading. Then in the 17th year of Yogen, Emperor Daiso heard about the reputation of the master's way and wanted to see how the master looked. So he summoned him to the capital. The master humbly refused to follow the order. This was repeated three times, and each time he refused because of illness. He didn't want to go. On the fourth try, the emperor ordered his envoy, if he does not stand up and come, cut off his head and bring it to me. The envoy went to the mountain monastery and explained the emperor's order. The master stretched out his neck for the sword, becoming divinely solemn and composed. So he stretched out, go on. Go on, cut it off then if you want. Cut it off, he stretched out his neck. By the way, and I've mentioned this a few times in the past too, you remember ancient China, the emperor, and even still today, this is the case, the mandate of the emperor is given by heaven. Okay. So emperors have got this, and also leaders, they have this pact with the population that they're there because of heaven. You know, because of some divine heavenly occurrence, if you like. So if they don't have that relationship is really important to the Chinese. And they need to maintain that, you know. So what happened was, if there was any Buddhists or Confucianists or Taoists, depending on the flavor of whatever religion the emperor or the leader had at the time, if there was someone that was famous or seen by the population as being holy or divine or anything like that, the emperors summoned them in because they wanted to have them on their side as a sign that God or that heaven is with them, because that famous monk or whoever it might be was residing then at the palace. And in Zen, that happened quite often, and we have quite a few stories about that. You know, it's one of the reasons the monks went to the forests to hide from that, because they couldn't practice. Once they became, if you like, famous, then career monks, if you like, as part of the entourage of an emperor, their practice was gone because they had to conform, you know. So he obviously didn't want to go. He wanted to continue his practice. So he stretched out his neck for the sword, becoming divinely solemn and composed. The envoy thought it was extraordinary, turned back and reported the master's attitudes to the emperor. The emperor respected and admired the master even more and expressed his reverence with a gift of preciously embroidered cloth. Thus the master could maintain his original determination. On the fourth day, which was a leap day, of the ninth month in the second year of Ikai of the emperor Koso, he suddenly spoke to his followers. All things are thoroughly liberated. That's what he said. So you can see that, you can see the link with his original enlightenment experience. All things are thoroughly liberated. from the beginning, all things are thoroughly liberated. Each one of you must keep this well in mind and continuously save the entire future. Each one of you must keep this well in mind and continuously save the entire future. So in another translation, in another book, because when I looked at it, save the entire future, it's a strange saying. So in another translation it says, pass it on to posterity. So each of you, so all things are thoroughly liberated, originally liberated, originally free, originally saved. Each one of you must keep this well in mind and continuously pass it on to prosperity. That is the Buddha's project. All things are originally liberated. There is nothing lacking. That's the entire Buddhist project, to get to that point where we can clearly see that. There is nothing. What is holding you back? He said, nothing is holding me back. That's the koan. Why are you still searching? You know, we've got to get to a point where we see that all things are originally liberated. The only thing that doesn't make it so is us interfering with it, us thinking it to be otherwise. That's the only thing that stops us from seeing that. As he finished speaking, he sat peacefully in Zazen and expired. He was 72 years old. They entombed him in there on the mountain. The next year, on the eighth day of the fourth month, the door of the tomb opened by itself. The master looked just as if he were alive. After that, his disciples did not dare to shut the door again. Later, he was given the posthumous name of Dai Yi, great physician, by the emperor. So again, I mean, there's a lot of legends that surround all of this all the time. So we've got to separate for ourselves whether we believe it or not. It's up to us. But there's a lot of legends that surround these things. So, now we come to the Taisho, which is Kaizen wrote this Taisho in the 12th century or 13th century. Kaizen's Taishos are also always very insightful. So he goes on, although there is neither superiority nor inferiority in the conduct of the patriarchs. Okay, it starts right there. There's neither inferiority or superiority, okay, of the patriarchs. So that perspective is already, superiority. What's superiority? What's inferiority? We add that. Someone says something, we say, that's superior. Someone else says, that's inferior. And that's how it starts. So superior and inferior. That's how the whole thing starts off. And of course, our mind then goes on, well, is this not it? Is it inferior? Is it superior? And off it goes. And he says, although there is neither superiority nor inferior, even in the conduct, so even any type of conduct, if I now shoot someone, there is neither superiority or inferiority. There's just bang. Now I add to it, ooh, that's a sin, or there is a precept of not killing, or that was just, he's defending himself, or he's defending our country, so we should, he's a hero, or he's a villain because he should. We add, and of course that's what we do, humans do that, and we need to do that in order to function. That's a functionality of it, the add-ons. But we believe it to be true, whichever side we take. And then we attach to that one side. We attach to that, and it's that attachment that binds us. So there's neither superiority nor inferiority of the patriarchs. That's the first insight. There's neither superiority nor inferiority in the conduct of the patriarchs. It doesn't matter, ultimately. But of course, in another way, it does matter. But that gives us the freedom to see it. And although the great master cherished the teaching of emptiness from his youth, as if he had learned it since his former lives, He never approached emperors or their officials all through his life and never retrogressed into firm determination, always learning and constantly practicing. In other words, it never went to his head. He didn't become a career monastic, you know, like some people do, you know. They become career clergy, bishops and what have you, you know. He remained, if you like, he remained true to his practice. He continuously practiced. He continuously was a hermit, if you like, you know. In the beginning, he goes on to say, in the beginning, he proclaimed and expounded the Dharma gate of liberation. And as he died, he opened up the Dharma gate of liberation, thus letting people know that in the end, life and death would never bind us at all. So you can see that his initial experience carried through his entire life, if you like, because it comes on back to that principle of the Dharma gate of liberation. So it says he proclaimed and expounded the Dharma gate of liberation. So what is the Dharma gate of liberation? And he died, he opened up the Dharma gate of liberation, thus letting people know that in the end, life and death would never bind us at all. So again, I mean, I know I repeat this all the time, over and over again, but we've got to get to a point where we see that. The Dharma gate of liberation. We've got to see that from the beginning, there is absolutely nothing that binds us. And for that, for us to be able to see that, we say we have to have an experience of it. And yes, to really see that, we need something needs to shift, you know. And that shifting, you know, is what he said when he says that in the end, life and death would never bind us at all. As long as we believe in life and death, there's a me, that I'm dying, or there's a you, you're dying. And there's dying. There is dying. And so that's why that theme of life and death comes up over and over and over and over again, because that's the ultimate way that we can see this. The deathless, it's also called the deathless part, you know. So, and again, you know, if I look at this, here's death. Right, here's death. Why is, what do you mean there's death? There's a tree, it used to be a tree, it's got death. When you look at back where this came from, it came from nothing but death. Death is a word that describes something. Wood, paper, bleach to make it white, ink. It's all gone, all the ink is gone, it's right here, it's all gone, it's dead. So right here is death. It's alive. It's alive. Have a look. It cannot be but alive. It's alive. This is dead. This is alive. Guess what? It's unborn. It's unborn. The future. It's unborn. Why is it unborn? Now have a close look. It's born. It's born. It's dead. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's dead. It's alive. It's unborn. Right from the beginning. It never was otherwise, never can be otherwise. Right from the beginning. That's what you got to see. Right from the beginning. It never was any other way. And that's the same with any form, including myself. How can I die? How can I live? How can I be in the future? I'm always there. You know, just like this. Is that piece of paper I showed you, is that dead? It's ridiculous. Whoops. It's ridiculous to think that this is dead. It's alive. It's unborn. Unborn. Look, birth. Look at all the births. Look at the twins now. It's continuously, it's right now happening all at once, all the time. The degree to which I can let go of myself, I can see that. If I'm stuck in this is me, this is you, you know. This is nothing but all, the all of existence. You know, just take this further, this image. It's all of existence is right here. All of existence. At any given moment, all the time. So, what's the gate? What's the gate of liberation? What's holding you back? So you see the difference between, oh, I've got to work on it, like it is in some, like we've got to work and chip away at our defilements or at our hindrances in order to get to a point where we see this. That's one way of teaching it, you know. And that's in many ways the Christian way or the religious way, you know, including the Buddhist way, certainly in some other traditions. But here, you know, from a Mahayana or from a Zen perspective, you're already there. You've got to get that. You're already there. There's actually nothing to do. So when we sit and we sit in meditation, please sit like that. Sit like, we say, sit like a Buddha, but even that's too much because Buddha is nothing as if there is a Buddha. Just sit. There's just sitting, nothing else to do. Of course, there's swirling maras all around us, and mara or our shadows keep interfering all the time. Don't pay any attention to it. Let it come, let it be, let it go, just like the rain and clouds. Just sit. There's nothing binding you. Really nothing binding you. And that's the message, you know. And the degree to which you can see that, it's the degree to which you are liberated. We have this, in prison we teach this module on anxiety. And anxiety is a big one. It is one of the biggest aspects that binds us, is anxiety. Okay. So the exercise that we do is, look at anxiety in the face. So you sit, okay? Now the fact that you're already looking means it's gone. Actually, when you put your focus on anxiety, it's like, where is it? Like, where is it? Where is anxiety? And in this life, it's totally liberating. You can't find it. Where is anxiety? You know, where is this anxiety? Then, of course, then it goes, okay, well, what do you feel? You might feel butterflies in the stomach, or you might feel some sensation or whatever. Well, look at that. You just look at it, you know. You take the story away. You take the mental deliberations or the proliferations or the, you take that mental stuff away. There's nothing there. There's nothing binding us. There's nothing binding us. Even health, you know. You know, some of us here have health issues, you know. What's binding us? It's just organisms growing all the time. We call them cold or COVID or tumors or whatever we call them, you know. But ultimately, there's nothing binding us, you know, if we see it from that perspective. The what is binding us, of course, is our need for it to be otherwise. That's what binds us. Our sense of it needs to be otherwise. I want it to be different. That's what's binding us. Which is, of course, a self-referencing ego thing. So, where were we? So it talks about life and death would never bind us at all. He was truly an extraordinary person, a person encountered but one in 1,000 years. The practice of the gate of emptiness is called the teaching of liberation right from the beginning. So this is really important. Right from the beginning, it's not that we are liberated now or when you have a Kensho experience. It's not that's not when you're liberated. You are liberated right from the beginning. You And when I say you, I don't mean you. I mean the whole existence. See, this is where language, of course, tricks us all the time. We fall into this you and me, and that keeps us trapped in this you and me. You know, when I say, you know, nothing binds you. There is no you from the start. It's just this. There's no you. What are you? As I keep on saying, nothing but mandarins and whatever you had for dinner for the last 10 years. That is nothing but you. You know. Why is that? If neither living beings nor Buddhas bind you, how could you be associated with life and death at all? So that's what he's saying. If neither living beings nor Buddhas bind you, if there's no I, there's no I, how can you be associated with life and death at all? Just one continuous existence, one seamless existence. You can look at it that way, as in, you know, if the I is gone, there is just one seamless existence. The I is gone, then whatever I see, you know, as in, of course, I have to use the word I now. Whatever I see, there's actually not whatever I see. There's just the scene, you know. There's just one continuous existence. And if I start separating it, there's this, there's that, that's that. I keep on then falling back into this trap of binding. Okay, this being so, it should not be pondered and argued on the level of body and mind. So in other words, be careful. Don't ponder it too much, because we get trapped in this thinking mind again. Neither should it be judged and discerned in terms of delusion or enlightenment. How can there be delusion and enlightenment? If you say it's enlightenment, then there's delusion. If everything is one, how can there be one or the other? You know, delusion is nothing but enlightenment. Enlightenment is nothing but delusion. You may speak of mind, you may speak of objective world, you may speak of delusive passions and of the supreme ways. All these are just different names for your own self. So all these are but different names for your own self. So here, own self refers to one existence. So this, and again, it's not easy to see, but it's When they talk about true self or own self, because we have to use word, what that signifies is all of existence, your own self, your true self, or I alone, or these are all words, of course, that point to one existence. Therefore, mountains and rivers are not separate from each other. Mountains and rivers are not separate from each other, nor is there any differences between your bodily existence and your external environment. If you see the deathless, there is no difference between you and your external environment, mountains, rivers, and so forth. Therefore, when it is cold, the cold kills you. So another way of saying that, therefore, if it is cold, the appearance of you disappears. The cold kills you. It's just cold. It's just cold. So when it's just mu, and this is the idea with mu. If you get mu, it's like mu kills. It doesn't kill you, but it kills the delusion of you, because you weren't there from the start. So if you can say that there is a me and that kills me, you know, that's still deluded. It's like there's never a you in the first place, but it appears that the world appears as me and as I and as you. That's an appearance. That's how it appears. But when you get to this spot where this switch has flicked, where you all of a sudden see it, there is no you or I, and therefore you can't say it like that. It's like the appearance is there, and I call that appearance you and me and cushion and mountain and rivers, but actually it's not even there. It's not there. You know. So this is what he's pointing to. They're all just different names for your own self. Therefore, mountains and rivers are not separate from each other, nor is there any difference between your bodily existence and your external environment. Therefore, when it is cold, the cold kills you, or kills the appearance of you, or what you think is you. When it is hot, the heat kills you. There's only heat. But somehow we experience heat as in me experiencing heat. You know. Furthermore, when this barrier is overcome once for all, it does not depend upon any known principle at all. Namely, there is neither bondage nor liberation. As I said many times before, there's neither bondage nor liberation. There's no such thing as enlightenment. That's just another trap, you know. Neither there nor here. Therefore, nothing can uphold its name. Not one thing can define its shape. Shape is, not one thing can define its shape. Shape is continuously, we call it shape, but it's a continuous unfolding. Therefore, you have exhausted all endeavors and accomplishments. How could it be associated with phenomena and essence? So it refers here to Kun Ko and Hensho. So when we get to the end of the Koan curriculum, there's different stages of seeing this, the five stages, and we go through them as part of the Koan work. So the first stage is you encounter emptiness, or you encounter Zen. This is the first, like, we're all here, we're encountering it, you know. The next minute is you see it. You see the emptiness of it all. You see the no self within the phenomena. You realize, you get it, that there is actually no self. In other words, everything is made up of something else. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a cushion or a computer. Everything is made up of other things. There's no self in there. There's no such thing as a computer. It's just parts. And then you take each part, and we call that keyboard. Well, there's no such thing as a keyboard either, because that is made up of something else. So you cannot find anything that is actually, that's it, because everything is made up of everything else. That's encountering emptiness. That's encountering, when you really get that, that's the second level. Then all of a sudden, the next level is you only see emptiness. You see the whole thing as just being empty. And then the next level is, you see everything but form again. You see the form. You see that there's nothing other than form. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. You know. So these are the different stages. You know, and then the last stage is the transcendence of it all. You see beyond. You go beyond it. You know. So these are the different levels. So anyway, he's criticizing that a little bit here, saying, "You have exhausted all endeavors and accomplishments. How could it be associated with phenomena or essence?" So he's basically saying these are all conceptual ways of looking at it. You should not abide within the distinctions of horizontal and vertical. Don't abide anywhere. What's horizontal? What's vertical? It depends on which way you look at it. I can go like that, it's horizontal. I can go like that, it's vertical. It's like, it's all fluid, if you like. If you can see it in this way, you will no more use the word liberation. That even liberation. How could you detest bondage? How can you detest bondage? It's like, how can you detest anxiety? How can you? That's like saying, I detest paper. Yeah. How can you detest anxiety? It's just, where is it? Where is this anxiety? Where is this anxiety? How can you detest anxiety? Really have a look at anxiety. Bring me your anxiety. Let it show itself. How can you detest, you know, how can you detest bondage? Then it goes on. Yet a true radiance, Kaizen is saying, is with you. And this is called seeing the three worlds. So again, this goes into Buddhist cosmology. Desire, form, and the formless are the three worlds. A true radiance is with you. So a true radiance is with you. It's, again, this is a formulation. You know, he's just trying to describe what it is that, and to say it's with us, this true radiance, you know, this freedom, you know, is another way of saying it, this freedom, this liberty, you know. Of course, you know, as soon as we use words, we get back into this dualism, but this is there, that's with you all the time. Your tongue possesses an excessive taste, and this is called blending the six tastes. Thus you emanate lights at all places and provide with delicacies at all times. When you taste something, there actually is deep taste where there is no taste at all. When you look at this and that, there actually is the true color. Where there exists no word of color at all, So here it's like, you know, it goes back to the taste and seeing and so forth. But if you look at color, for instance, you know, nowadays we know there's no such thing as color. You know, our mind projects color. That's what happens. It's the same as we project taste. You know, someone says, "Ooh, that tastes bitter." Someone says, "Well, it's not that bitter." It's like I say, this is white, and this is yellow, and this is black. You know, but this is our mind's functioning that does it. In reality, according to physics, there is no color. But we have a way of our makeup is so that we discern color. Some people are colorblind. You know, certain animals don't see color at all. So it's like that. So don't get stuck on this is the way it is. Therefore, there are no emperors or officials to approach, nor a body and mind that sits or lies down. You know, there's no one that lies down. That is just a description that we have that says you are lying down. Someone is lying down. There's no emperor. There's no, you know, this is just a made up world that we make up. You know, we make this up, but in reality, you know, in reality, there is no such thing as an emperor. That is just a title. Just like there is no teacher, you know, or master or whatever. These are just titles that we make up. If you can reach this dimension, then the great master, the fourth patriarch, is nobody but you, my people. If you can reach that dimension, then the fourth patriarch is nobody but you, my people. He's saying, there's no separation. You, my people, you are certainly the great master, the fourth patriarch. You are nothing but the fourth patriarch. No separation. You know, isn't this the meaning of all things are the gate of liberation? He goes on. Isn't that the meaning of all things are the gate of liberation? All things, a small pebble, a cushion, a dirty nappy, all things are all. There's all. All things are the gate of liberation. Everything is everything. Nothing left out, nothing separate. Isn't that, he's saying, isn't this the meaning of all things are the gate of liberation? Isn't this the meaning of saving continuously? Saving continuously. How do you save a ghost? Do you remember that, Cohen? How do you save a ghost? Isn't this the meaning of saving continuously the entire future? And this is, I don't know to what degree you get this. This is, I can get tears in my eyes when I read this. Isn't this the meaning of saving continuously the entire future? So here, you know, saving the entire future is letting go of all things that you think can't be saved. Everything is saved right from the beginning. Everything is absolutely complete. Absolutely complete. And with that, you know, with that insight, you know, liberation is just another word. It's just what do you need to get liberated from? What do we need to get liberated from? It's a joke. Yeah. The door of the seamless tomb suddenly opens. The tomb, the seam, no death. The seamless tomb suddenly opens. The door of the seamless tomb suddenly opens by itself. Always, you know. And the ever ordinary features are most peacefully manifested. So, in every action, phenomena, it's all manifested right there. Now, I have some humble words today too. With them, I would like to express the meaning of the story. Would you like to listen to them? So this is Now, when Kaizen offers his verse, and the verse is like a condensed form of, you know, of the koan. So, in by the way, when we practice koan work, we don't go through this whole thing. We just go through the take to the case and the verse. So these are in this particular book. They're the two parts we work with. So it goes on. So this is what he wrote: the mind is void. The pure wisdom knows no wrong nor right. So the mind is void. See, wrong and right already falls into a mind that is not void. The mind is void. Pure wisdom knows no wrong or right. You know, this pure wisdom, you know. In other words, you see things truly as they are. You know, of course we layer it with right and wrong, and that sometimes is important. But first get to the point where you don't attach to the right and wrong. See that no right, no wrongness, you know. The mind is void, you know, from the start. You know, pure wisdom knows no right, no right. Herein, you do not know what binds you. It's right. Herein, you do not know what binds you. If you see that emptiness of it all, nothing can bind you. Or what you will be liberated from. Even that, it's nothing to be liberated from. Nothing binding us, but also nothing to be liberated from. Right from the beginning. Even if the five aggregates and four elements, so the five aggregates are form, you know, as well as perception, conception, volition, consciousness, so this is again going back into Buddhism, and the five elements, the three elements, earth, water, fire, and air, sorry, the four elements, even if the five aggregates and the four elements are separated, so even if you separate them, there's air, there's fire, there's water, and so forth, separated. Even if the five aggregates and four elements are separated, seeing, hearing, voices, and colors are ultimately no other. So ultimately, no other means ultimately no existence. You know, means, sorry, not no existence, ultimately one existence. Ultimately all one existence, just different words for this oneness. Just different words that we use to express this oneness. But of course, we get stuck. We get stuck in the separation of it, or we get stuck in the world of separation all the time. Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.